Hello, everybody. Great to be back again, and great to see all of you from all over the world coming in. So, thank you for spending this time together. And the way we'll begin is with a guided meditation. So, I'll offer some guiding, and then we'll do some silent sitting. It'll be about 25 minutes. So, why don't we just go ahead and begin? So, just beginning by feeling yourself, feeling your body in the cushion, the chair, wherever you find yourself in this moment, and just feel the sense of presence, feel the sense of inhabiting this space and this body, and just arriving here together to do this practice together. And taking a few deep conscious breaths, just feeling the breath moving through the body, and hopefully just letting it soothe you, allowing you to rest and arrive in this moment. And we'll begin with a brief body scan just to begin to release any tension that you may find in your body. So let's start at the top of the head and move downward. So just bringing your attention to the top of your head, to your eyes. And if you would like to close your eyes or to keep them soft focus, whatever feels right to you, there's not a right or wrong. Bringing the attention to the nose, cheeks, the mouth, the jaw, and just letting go of any tightness you may find. And now bringing attention down to the neck, to the shoulders, just relaxing. Moving attention down to the arms, elbows, all the way down to the hands, and just letting go. And now bringing attention to the torso, and bringing attention to where you feel the breath. And if you can, just relax your belly a bit and take a few more deep conscious breaths, feeling the breath in the body. Feeling your back, if it's against a chair, feeling the contact of the back against the chair, and feeling the support. And also aware of where you're sitting, feeling the contact of the chair or the cushion, feeling supported, feeling held up. Bringing attention down to the legs, the knees, the shins, and all the way down to the feet, just letting go of any tension. And now, in this moment, bring awareness to all of the places in which your body is making contact with the chair, cushion, floor. Just feeling the gentle sensations of the contact. And now, also bringing attention to the places in which there is space around the body, where there is no contact. Just feeling the difference, just being aware and holding the sensations of the body, both in terms of contact and spaciousness. Perhaps feeling a sense of grounding. And ease. And bringing attention back to the breathing. If you have access, some people may have difficulty accessing the breath for various reasons, often related to trauma. And if that's the case for you, you can anchor your attention at the sensations of the body. So whatever is most connecting for you, anchoring the attention at the sensations of the breath in the body or the body itself, just feeling the presence, feeling the sensations all through the body. Allowing them to be as they are. If you happen to notice a strong sensation in the body, you can bring your attention to the sensation. Bring your mindful awareness to it with a spirit of curiosity and investigation. Just being aware of the sensations. Not changing, not doing anything, but just noticing. And noticing if the sensation is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is the Vedana or feeling tone. And again, not needing to do anything about it, but just to bring awareness to it and noticing if the sensation, as you bring your attention to it, perhaps it changes a bit, or it feels like it's moving, that it isn't completely static. And then as you feel too, bringing attention back to the breath or the body itself, letting yourself be anchored. And now noticing if there's any particular emotion that may be present for you. Whether it's sadness, happiness, excitement, grief, fear. And again, just allowing this emotion to be as it is, but also bringing awareness to where you feel the sensation most distinctly in the body. See if you can really notice where that emotion is most present in the body as a sensation. Just exploring a little bit about the sensation. Often when we bring our mindful awareness to sensations and emotions, we begin to see that they're not quite as fixed as we often think they are. Sometimes we can even find space within and through these sensations or emotions that often feel solid. But whatever you're experiencing, just allow, to the extent you can, your attention to rest gently with the sensation. And perhaps noticing how it changes and how it may show up as energy in the body. and noticing if there are any thoughts associated with the sensation or the emotion. And if you can, just see the thought as another appearance in the moment that arises and passes away. As we pay attention to sensations, thoughts, and emotion, we often see not only are they not solid, but we see how they come and go. We see their impermanence. We see they're not fixed. They're not self. They're just arising and passing. And as you breathe and as you sit here, you may even be able to begin to notice the space between the sensations or the emotions or the thoughts. You know, often we pay attention to what is most obvious in our consciousness, whether it's contact with the things around us. In a room, we notice the things in the room. In our minds, we often notice the thoughts, the feelings. And yet there's also space. There's always space in the room. And if we pay attention, there's space even between the breaths. We can attend to this space. Our awareness of it can begin to expand until we can hold it in the great space of awareness itself. And how this awareness is holding all of what's arising and passing in the moment, all of our experiences. No judgment, no right or wrong in this moment. And we may even be able to contact this experience as a loving awareness. Compassionate and kind and accepting and spacious. We don't have to do anything in particular to be held in this spacious, compassionate awareness. We just need to show up. It's not about being good enough. It's just about showing up. So we'll sit together these last 10 minutes in silence, and perhaps just once in a while I'll offer a reminder to return. And if the mind is drifting, just refresh gently your attention at the breath or the body. Just settling back. And coming back and refreshing the felt sense of this moment, the body, the breath, sensations, just knowing what it's like to be here, to be present, to be breathing, to be sitting together, sharing this very moment. And if you're drifting, gentle reminder to return to whatever you find present, but in a gentle and kind way, resting back into this body, into this breath, into this moment. Hello, everybody. Nice to see you all. Of course, I don't actually see you, but I know you're there. I feel your presence. And thank you for those who filled out in the chat where you're from all over the world. So it's great to be here with you this afternoon for me, but we're all on different time zones. So wherever you are and whatever time you are, we're still all here in this moment together. So I'm happy to see you all and to be here. And my talk is anticipatory approaches to, I mean, wise approaches to anticipatory stress and fear. And of course, not all fear is bad. Anticipatory stress, of course, can be life-saving. And I'll talk about that, and I'll talk about just general aspects of stress and how we can work with it. And perhaps find some approaches that will be helpful in creating more space around the stress that so many of us are facing right now in our lives. So one definition of dukkha or suffering is stress. And we can look at stress in many different ways. It's friction. It can be low level. It can be constant. It can be generalized discomfort, or it can be reacting to specific events or the inherent stress that we really find in the world right now. We're living at a time when stress is very high for many, many people, specifically climate change, which for most of us in most places in the world, it is becoming more and more evident, you know, something we can't turn away from anymore. It's just become a real it's becoming a crisis, and we're really experiencing it. And it's very stressful, both in terms of the anticipation of what will come, but also just dealing with it, you know, just the dealing with and working with the heat. And it can be, for some people, very dangerous, and it can be very difficult to meet every single day. You know, so it's a great concern. We also have ongoing social inequity. And in the U.S., we have near constant mass shootings. It starts to be scary to think about going to a 4th of July parade and having somebody shoot into the crowd. I mean, this is the kind of anticipatory stress that a lot of us face right now, all of these. And there's a lot to be concerned with. And the anticipatory stress is often what's next. And I really believe a great element of the Sangha and community is the chance to hold stress, whatever is arising, in a container of collective compassion, presence, acceptance. It's a kind of solidarity where we can hold together what's arising in a kind, loving way. And when we show up in Sangha in this way, we don't have to change how we feel in this moment. You know, we can come as we are. You know, we don't have to be something different or do something different. It's just this, just the way it is. And so, as I said, you know, all stress isn't bad. It can be protective. It can lead us to take appropriate action when needed. Even another aspect is when we take on stress to accomplish things in life. You know, we have ambitions in life often, and sometimes to meet those ambitions, we have to choose things that will be stressful short term. And then, of course, there are times when stress arises and we don't have a choice. And it just varies. You know, I'm always surprised to hear a very accomplished performers talk about how terrified they are in advance of a show, for instance. And so they've taken on this choice of dealing with this anticipatory stress. But it's a choice. And so sometimes it's a choice. And of course, sometimes it isn't. And it can be a motivating factor, especially if we meet it with awareness. But quite often, because of conditioning, our immediate perception is that stress is wrong or bad or should be eliminated. And so if that response is there, it sometimes is hard to then navigate the terrain in a way that can help us to actually respond in a way that allows it to be either helpful or to let it go or to find the right action. And so if we have a reaction, then we often ask, what can I do to maneuver around it, to fix it? Maybe I can eliminate it through meditation. And maybe that's the wrong question. You know, as I heard one person say, the best journeys in life answer questions you didn't even know you had. So then how do we reengage the question around stress? Sometimes we need to ask different questions. How do I meet it with kindness, awareness, wise action? So we're just looking at this, just creating a container to explore this. And so, as I said, you know, anticipatory stress can be protective, and it can even be life-saving. And I had an experience with this recently in the desert Southwest. And one of the things that I was reminded of was a story that I read not too long ago about a young couple who were hiking in California. I think it was the Sierra Nevada mountains, and they were with their young child, their infant, and a dog. And some of you are probably familiar with this story, but they set out on their hike. I think it was a day-long hike, and they set out on their hike, and it was maybe about 70 degrees. And I don't know how many miles it was, maybe about 10 miles or so, or I'm not sure exactly, but as they got further into their hike, it got far hotter than they knew it would be or that they thought it would be. The temperature was not clear how high it would go as they got further into their hike. So as they came over the top of a mountain, were coming over the other side, they came to a point where it was, I believe, around 100 degrees or maybe even above, and there was no shade, and they were all out of water. And so they started to have hypothermia, and the cell phone wasn't functioning for them to get help. And so it's really tragic for me to think about. They sat there knowing that they were dying, and there was no way to to get help. There was nothing they could do. And of course, tragically, they all died. And they were only a mile and a half from their vehicle. But the planning, the awareness around how to be prepared for this hike, there had not been enough anticipation to look all the way through the possible scenarios. And it's not, no blame. I mean, it could happen to any of us. I mean, this kinds of thing happens often, but it's just tragic to think about how, sometimes we're not aware enough. Sometimes there needs to be a little bit of healthy fear to motivate us to do what we need to do to care for ourselves in certain circumstances. And, you know, I read something that I thought was really interesting, and it was a study that was done around who handles, who survives the best in difficult circumstances, like getting lost on a hike, getting lost in the woods. And interestingly enough, there was some evidence that children actually survive better than adults who are more experienced and think they know what to do, but they don't have the instinct. So children often will rely more on instinct to survive and make better choices because of it, instead of maybe going through the ideas of, you know, panicking and thinking I should do this, this, and this. It's just interesting to think about the fact that sometimes we humans lose connection with the wiser part of ourselves that might be able to guide us, you know. And a lot of times in this Dharma practice, we're opening ourselves to a deeper wisdom that's outside of our conditioned patterns that can often show us a way and help us through difficulties that we may not maneuver through as skillfully otherwise. And so my husband and I spent about a month in the desert southwest in June. And my husband loves archaeology. And so we were going to a lot of ancient sites, Native American sites. And we picked June thinking it wouldn't be quite as hot, but guess what? It was sweltering. I mean, every single day we were looking at temperatures going up the upper 90s, even 100s. And so I remember one day we were going out to a particular site and we seemed to be getting lost. You know, we were going down dirt roads. We were going down these different paths trying to find the site. And as we were driving along, what I noticed was that the temperature from 7:30 to 8 a.m. in the morning went from 70 to 90 degrees in 30 minutes. And so I kind of wondered if we should continue. I was concerned that it was just going to get later and later into the day and it was going to be even more, you know, more sweltering. Maybe we should go back. Maybe we should stop. So the fear at this point, the stress, you know, it was starting to go from being what I would call protective to getting like worried, you know, like getting into dukkha, getting to be uncomfortable. It became a weight or a lens through which everything was being seen in that moment, you know, and I was like, well, I have a sun allergy. Are we going to have enough water? And not knowing where we were going. And I asked my husband to recheck our navigational device, and he did, and found that we just needed to go a little bit further down the road, and we made it to the park. And, you know, I looked at the length of the hike. I looked at how much water we had. I put on a sun hat. And I decided that we would be okay. In this situation, I felt that we would be safe. And so I relaxed into the experience and I saw that it was okay. And so then I could let go. And so the anticipatory stress and fear was there initially to make sure that we were safe, make sure that we were, you know, taking care of ourselves. And my husband was on top of it as well, but I think I was a little bit more concerned than he was. But then once it was clear that we were okay taking the right action, we were okay to take a hike. And I was able to enjoy the hike without any further fear or personal identification around, you know, sun reaction. And it was enjoyable. The heat was definitely unpleasant. I will say that it was very, very hot, but it wasn't unbearable. It wasn't suffocating. And I knew that the length of time that we had chosen for the hike was such that it would be okay. Another aspect of this hike that I wasn't expecting, it wasn't just this hike. It was actually the 2 or 3 weeks that we were spending going around to all of these sites was that there were many background stories about the Native American lives, what happened, the history there. And I think, although living in America, I know the history of what happened. And I have to say that as I learned and studied more and more about the plight of what happened to the Native Americans, it became more and more overwhelmingly distressing to my heart. Awareness of the genocide, it was overwhelming and very stressful emotions. The past felt present. And seeing the legacy of climate change in this moment, and then seeing our history in the United States with Native Americans, it all just kind of came together and it felt so intertwined. And each time I would read about this, I would become very emotional. And it was a kind of stress that was arising in my body around the heartbreak. Each time I would go, I would have to turn away when I would read the history and the tears would come. And so it was a building of stress in my body. And then finally, the last day of our trip, I sat to meditate in the morning. And it's like suddenly all the sadness and the heartbreak just arose. And it was like almost an earthquake. I just wept. And I was able to grieve. And I was able to have that space to do that, which was building up in my body. And there was nothing in that moment that I could do, but I could meet that. I could meet the heartbreak that was arising. And I think a lot of us, a lot of times we may experience heartbreak around the state of the world. And sometimes there's the idea, you know, I want to do something right away. Or I want to sit with it. Sometimes it becomes almost a dichotomy. Should I take action? Should I sit? And sometimes the energy of that even creates more stress. What do I do? What do I do in this moment? And that can be a really challenging thing, you know, because it's like, how do I meet this? And sometimes, though, we need to be aware. Are we taking a forward step away from the experience? In other words, the experience is so heartbreaking and overwhelming, I just want to get away from it. I'll do something, but I don't know if what I'm doing is the right thing just yet. And of course, finding action is a big part of the Dharma path. So right and skillful action is a huge element of our path. But skillful action, how do we find the intention to meet that, to meet our hearts? And not the intention to escape the stress that we might be feeling. So sometimes in our Dharma practice, we can take a backward step into the heartbreak, into the not knowing, into what's arising. And then from here, step forward with our whole being engaged. So it's not an either or. I think a lot of people have thought maybe meditation practice can become an escape. But then other people who have been very engaged in action become so burnt out that they really need the space of the practice and the rest to rejuvenate. And so I think we really bringing these two together are what create a far more holistic approach. And so we want to honor and meet our experience, our suffering and our pain and our heartbreak, but not to be frozen. And so this is part of the path of the Eightfold Path that Buddha laid out, which I'll read a little bit more about at the end of our talk here. And a lot of Buddha's path was focused on action, but it was also focused on meditation. And so we have both. And so coming back to something I said earlier, a lot of times we choose stress in life to accomplish something. So it's in a way we make a bargain, like I'll handle and I'll deal with this stress in order to achieve something, a goal. You know, I read an article recently called Why People Choose to Suffer. And it was about the suffering of choosing stress to accomplish something, like public speaking. Many people have a fear of public speaking and many other things. Maybe a person who has a very busy job, but they decide they want an advanced degree, but they're going to have to do it. They're going to have to squeeze it in. And it can be stressful at times, you know, to try to get it all done or whatever might speak to you around this. And for me, you know, public speaking was, in fact, something that when I was younger literally terrified me. I mean, it scared me in a way that if I had to give a presentation when I was working in business, a presentation in front of six people, I remember the first time I had to do that, I actually hyperventilated. And my boss kind of broke me out of it by asking me a very specific question. But then at the end of the meeting, he came up to me and said, you know, you could probably learn to speak better if you took Toastmasters or you took some kind of class. So I started going to Toastmasters to try to deal with my stress. And it helped me. But one thing I learned was that the difficulty I feel around public speaking is not something to get rid of. You know, it used to be, here are the strategies to get rid of the stress. Here are the strategies to try to eliminate it. But what I learned was it was better to make friends with it. It was better to say, this is part of my experience of choosing this path of public speaking as part of my livelihood, is to say, this stress, this anxiety is going to come right along with me, and I will meet it as a friend, and I will allow it to be part of my experience, and I won't try to get rid of it. And that really took it down a notch. It took away the stress of pushing against it, of fighting it, of trying to get rid of it. So it allowed a space for it to be here. And that made such a difference. And I realized that just even in bringing awareness to my body as I spoke, that it wasn't bringing awareness to the body in order to get rid of something, but just to be with what is actually true in this moment. And so as we're speaking now, that's what I'm doing. I'm aware of my body, and I'm aware that there's a subtle stress that I have when I speak, but it's all part of this present moment experience. And so it's okay. I'm not trying to fix or eliminate. And I think a lot of times the deeper dukkha and stress comes when we then kind of fight against what's already arising. And we have often in anticipatory stress, not knowing what's coming. And in that not knowing what's coming, it's almost more comfortable in a really weird way to imagine the worst outcomes than to be in the not knowing of what's coming. And so the mind will often go to those scenarios. And that's something I've done many times when I was trying something new. I remember some years ago, my husband and I were going to learn how to do scuba diving. And I started thinking of all the worst case scenarios. Like, what happens if you're underwater and you have to throw up? You know, that's the one that came to me, just like this worst case scenario. And of course, there's a solution to that. But the mind was going to all these different scenarios, you know, because in a way, sitting in the rawness and the open space of not knowing felt so much more vulnerable. And a lot of working with this kind of anticipatory stress and fear is to acknowledge vulnerability, to acknowledge this is what's arising, this is what's here. You know, not necessarily to jump to fix it right away, but just to say, this is what's here, meeting it with our mindful awareness in a compassionate, friendly way, and perhaps even giving ourself permission to rest in this terrain of not knowing. And in resting in this terrain of not knowing, often what arises is something that offers a clarity of action that we might not have seen otherwise, or else we just have a chance to rest a little bit. And so I wanted to tell another story about kind of anticipatory stress, something that happened to me when I was teaching a retreat last year. And this is a retreat center that I've been teaching at for quite a few years, but there's a hiking trail that I had heard about that was a little bit off the property. And that was a beautiful hike that you go all the way up to the top of the mountain. And I'd never really had time while I was teaching to go do that hike. But there was one afternoon between lunch and the first session that looked like there would be a possibility of my going. And so I went ahead and went on that hike. And so you walk off, it was kind of a gravel road, and I walked off the property and I went around to, there's a gate, there's like a metal gate, and it's just a gravel, an old gravel road. There's nothing up there. So I just kind of walked around the gate and started walking up, and it's a completely deserted area. There are no houses around. There's nobody on the road. It's just a trail up to the, an old road up to the top of the mountain. Now, because it was so deserted, as a female, and some of you women will relate to this, I'm always kind of calculating if I'm going out on a hike, and I do love to hike. I'm always calculating, is this particular hike safe? You know, is this a place that I can hike and I'm not too concerned, you know, about my well-being or my safety? You know, that calculation is almost always being done in my mind. And so I hadn't really considered that there would be any concern. But as I was walking up the gravel road, I saw a truck that had been coming up the road behind me as I was going up to the gate and beyond. And I noticed that it had followed behind me, and they stopped, and I heard them opening the gate. And I was a little bit nervous because I didn't know who it was or what they were doing up there. And so as I walked up, you know, a little anticipatory stress arose. And so I saw a mound over to my side. So I walked up over the mound and kind of went behind, you know, kind of avoiding, I didn't really want to encounter that truck. And so the truck started coming up the road. And as it was going up the road, I came back around the mound back a little bit lower. And I noticed when I did that the truck came to a stop as if it was looking for me, as if the person was looking for me in some way. And so I got a little bit nervous at this point and started walking faster, you know, I wanted to get away from the road there and get back to the property. And I noticed myself being nervous, and I had my cell phone with me, you know, just kind of felt like, you know, maybe if I needed it. And so there was anticipatory stress arising. And yet I was also very mindful. You know, I was teaching a meditation retreat, which was helpful, but there was a kind of mindfulness that was with me that was allowing me not to panic, but to do the right thing. You know, I didn't like break out into a run so much as I was just walking very quickly and mindfully. And so I had my awareness with me as I was walking back to the property and getting back onto the ground. So it was like that awareness, that mindfulness was present. So it wasn't just the visceral fear or the fear or the panic, the uncertainty, but it was just guiding me back to getting back to the place. So I was fortunate that there was enough mindfulness and awareness to, you know, guide me back. And so this stress, you know, we can look at stress as being friction of two things rubbing against each other. The resistance that an object encounters when moving over another. In a sense, it's duality. There's something in opposition to something else. And then tension creates the friction. And with the practice, one of the things we can do is to relax that sandpaper of friction. It smooths it out and the object slides by. And this comes from cultivation of awareness. And even the practice of breath can be a way of meeting and holding without eliminating. I think if we hold our intention not to use the breath or the body to get rid of stress, but to meet it with tenderness, not to eliminate, to soothe. I mean, one of the things we can do with our practice is to let the breath be as waves, like waves on a beach, soothing out the raggedy sands of our minds. You know, we can actually go beneath the mental activity of the mind and find peace and equanimity. And we can bring this to our lives. But if the expectation, the intention is to eliminate, a gap arises, and that actually intensifies the stress. And so being able to see and work with this is part of the practice. And, you know, sometimes we're not able to strategize when a truly life-threatening situation arises. And all we can do is, if we can draw on our practice, wonderful. Sometimes we have to draw on instinct. You know, I went through a situation once where I think I'd been meditating for a couple of years, and I went out into an ocean in Hawaii where there were heavy current and waves, and people were warned not to go out there. And I just wanted to go out past the waves to do some body surfing, but I didn't have a board. And as I got further and further out, I saw that the waves were far too high for me to really even navigate the waves without having a board to hold me up or to do something. And so as I got out there, the waves started crashing on my head, and they were so big, and I didn't have any ground beneath me. So there was nothing above but these waves hitting me and no ground beneath. And I could barely come up for air. And so I was panicking. And I looked over, there was a lifeguard. And when I came up for air, I looked over at a lifeguard who didn't seem to see me. I knew I was on my own. Like, what am I, you know? And so there was definitely instinctual survival that had arose in me in that moment. But there was just enough awareness there to not panic. You know, quite often people drown in heavy currents when they panic. You know, they fight the current. And when you fight the current, it only makes it worse. You know, it's like you have to just pull yourself away from the current. There's a counterintuitive way of getting away from it that if you're aware enough, you know, just enough awareness not to panic. And so I had just enough awareness not to panic and to listen to my instincts about how to get back to shore. And honestly, I can't remember exactly how I got back. I can say that when I got out of the water, my body was like rubber. I was shaking and, you know, just totally like rubber and exhausted. But there had just been enough awareness, just enough to get through. And so it wasn't drowned out by fear. And so I want to read a quote. This is from the Buddha from the Pali Canon. On one occasion, Venerable Sariputta was saying in Magda Nikala village, a wanderer went to Venerable Sariputra and on arrival exchanged courteous greetings with him. After this, the exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to Venerable Sariputra, "Stress, stress, it is said, my friend Sariputra. What type of stress are they referring to?" "These are the three forms of stressfulness, my friend. The stressfulness of pain, the stressfulness of fabrication, the stressfulness of change. These are the three forms of stressfulness. But there is a path, there is a practice for the full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness." Then, Sariputra, what is the path? What is the practice for full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness? "Precisely the Noble Eightfold Path, my friend, right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the path, this is the practice for the full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness. It is an auspicious path, my friend, an auspicious practice for the full comprehension of stressfulness, enough for the sake of heedfulness." And so heedfulness is that point in which we're not so overcome with stress that we lose our choices. We have the capacity to be attentive and to find the proper response. It takes time, it takes trust, but it's there. And so just to sum it up, you know, some practices, some approaches. First, when stress is arising, we cultivate in our practice the ability to know it is arising and know when it passes. And this is something Buddha says. You know, he spoke of the monks knowing stress is present, stress has arisen, and knowing stress has passed. And so we're aware. And so we're not seeing it as wrong or something to get rid of. And we don't make it a self. We don't make it I or mine by over-identification. So if we just say stress has arisen, stress is present, stress is past. When you don't know what to do, acknowledge it, allow for not knowing, and trust the wisdom inherent in this experience. And then ask yourself, what is called for in this moment? Is it stepping back? Is it action? Is it meditation? Is it all of these? And then what along the Eightfold Path might be the most skillful in the moment? Is it speech, action, right mindfulness, resolve, concentration? All of these are there to help us and to support us. And when we can cultivate, perhaps most importantly, a quality of compassionate presence, of kindness, of acceptance of what's arising in our experience, we start to have more choices. We start to have more ability to meet our experiences in a more open a way where stress doesn't completely overcome us. Just as I did when I was looking at hiking in those ancient sites, and it was so hot or even walking and encountering that truck behind me. There are some choices that we have that we don't always see. And this practice, I think, really is what helps open us up and bring us into a greater capacity to meet these experiences. So I'll open up this talk now for Q&A, and I'll be happy to answer questions either in person or through the questions down at the bottom, and I'll see if we have anything yet. Okay, so the first question somebody asked, what is the relationship between anticipatory stress and distress? That's a good question. My feeling is, you know, the way I'll kind of explain it is there's an anticipatory stress that arises that can be very protective. It's a mechanism that I, you know, is often either built based on instinctual stress, or it can be built based on having enough experience with something to know this is dangerous, or this could be dangerous, this could be something that I need to deal with. Distress, I believe, arises when we're not meeting it with awareness. In other words, when that anticipatory stress begins to overtake our whole awareness, to where we lose our choice with how to meet it and how to be with it. And so it becomes overwhelm. And so then it becomes harder to meet it. It's not that it's impossible. In fact, if we do get to that point of overwhelm, I often will say, acknowledge, this is a moment of overwhelm. You know, what can I do? How can I take care of myself? And then can I meet it in a way that is perhaps more skillful at that point? Sometimes we got to step away before we can step back in. We have someone that would like to come on screen, Jane Miller. Do we have an ability to get Jane on the screen?
Here we are.
All right.
Thank you very much. Really, really wonderful. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I think it's really changing the whole view of stress. And we have such a tendency to judge emotions. And for me, I think stress really is something that is very critical to our well-being. So I look at it as a positive. It's telling me something that will help me then deal with what's happening. And I'll give an example, because I think eustress is really important, not just distress. When my dog was running down the beach one day, there was the rocks go out into the ocean. Well, whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And the lake was frozen. It wasn't the ocean. It was the lake. It was totally frozen. And I'm down the beach, and my dog takes off, runs to the down the rocks, and jumps into the lake.
Mm.
And it's frozen. And I'm watching my dog go down. I ran. I don't run fast, but I ran fast. The adrenaline, the stress I had, the adrenaline saved my dog's life.
Yeah.
Because when I got to the end of the rocks, I dove in. And I only weigh 95 pounds, and my dog weighed a lot too. And I just lifted her up and got her back up on the rocks. My friend arrives and she says, I thought you were going to get killed. And I was like, I'm fine, you know? And I think it's that kind of, you know, sometimes it's really important to embrace the stress. And really be compassionate. And also be aware of how to release it. And I'm going to stop now. But I just want to thank you because I think this is it's a very important topic with what's going on in our culture and in our, especially in the U.S. I don't know about other places because that's not where I am. But, you know, losing your rights and every day on the news, you know, it's really important to have lots of different approaches. But I think stress can be very positive in helping us cope. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing that. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. That motivated you to save your dog and you were okay. I'm glad to hear that everything turned out well. Yes. Thank you. And I think you shared also about losing our rights, which of course here in America, there's been Roe v. Wade, which was, you know, that's created a lot of stress, anticipatory stress for many women. What are we going to do again? So, you know, we have so much, so much right now that is so much in our experience. And I really believe sometimes we have this kind of low level stress that is with us for many of us almost all the time. And if we even just spent a day just bringing our compassionate kind awareness to all the moments of just even that low level stress, it can really help to give us a little bit more spaciousness around it. And maybe even looking at maybe how often to look at the news cycle and, you know, kind of step away so that it doesn't totally undermine the struggles that we have. So any questions? We got some time here for some more questions, comments.
Sorry, Lisa, sorry to interrupt, but I think that in question, the first question from Jerome, I think he wanted to come on screen. I don't know if you're willing to have him still. You've answered the question.
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't see that he wanted. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'll try to bring him.
Hi.
Hi.
Am I muted or you can see me?
We hear you. We see you.
Okay, good. The reason I asked the question is that my son, let's see, this would be 46 years ago, 1976, I was on my way to Esalen with Gabriel Roth. And my ex-wife called me and said my son was in the hospital. Mm. And they didn't know what it was. So when I got there, I found out he had a Wilms tumor, a cancer of the kidney that is usually fatal. Mm. And instead of panicking, I started getting on the phone to call the healers that I knew, the alternative healers, and connected with a psychologist that would help him with mind stories. It's what we called these guided meditations for a seven-year-old. Mm. And the thing is, I didn't feel any kind of distress. I felt like I knew what the solution would be. I knew I had to take advantage of my connections with alternative medicine to make this possible. Mm-hmm. I didn't find out till 4 years later that he was the first person in medical history to survive that Wilms tumor, cancer of the kidney. Wow. That had metastasized to his lungs. Mm. So now he's 53, has a three-year-old child, and has not had any indication of recurrence. Wow. So I just was trying to figure out what inside of me prevented me from getting stressed out and panicked about his health and to really take action towards his well-being rather than causing myself a lot of distress. by worrying and being, you know, like a totally concerned parent, which I was.
Wow, it sounds like just that deep love and connection just drove you right to the correct act. You know what I mean? It just sounds like you just, you know, that you were, it sounds like you were so in tune with something in yourself that was like, this is the right action. It was just there for you, just available. I don't know if you were practicing back then or if it was just totally a completely organic response. Sounds like it might have just been like you just something in you knew what to do. And
I had been practicing back then for sure.
Oh, you had?
Yeah, I wasn't a Buddhist at that time. Mm-hmm. I had studied yoga with Swami Rama and I learned about distress from Father Eli, and he had taught me this meditation technique of guiding people into deep state of relaxation and visualization. Mm-hmm. And I had all those tools with me, and I knew that that was how I was going to approach his illness. And when those first nights in the hospital, I had every other night with him, shared it with his mother. And my girlfriend and I would do these mind stories together to kind of implant a good seed in him to recover.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was a pretty miraculous thing, but there was very little stress.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's very inspiring. Very inspiring. And I'm so glad that action saved your son's life. Thank you.
Yeah, there was a repeat of that in 97 when I got cancer.
Wow.
And I did the same thing. I didn't panic. I started doing research on the internet. I survived more than 25 years.
Wow, wonderful. I'm glad you're here with us. Thank you. That's great. It's wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing. Okay, we have a question from Tay. Signs that stress is becoming unhealthy versus healthy stress. Boy, yeah, that's, I would say, you know, first, of course, overwhelm, you know, obsession, where the mind can't seem to release the fearful thoughts, you know, where we become totally preoccupied by, you know, by the outcome, bad feelings in the body, in the mind, just, and it becomes like a burden. You know, we can think of another way we can think of dukkha is like a burden that's weighing on us, you know, and the kind of stress that becomes obsessive and uncertain. We don't know what to do. We don't know what to not do. And most of us know when we're in that state, when it's like the state of overwhelm. We don't seem to have the choice of how to take action or how to sit with it or how to do anything. And I just see that as a form of, it can become obsessive and overwhelming, you know, to the point of debilitation, not being able to sleep. You know, we all know when we're dysregulated to that point where, as opposed to still having a choice, you know, a lot of the stress that's healthier and anticipatory, we still feel we have some agency, you know, some kind of agency around our response to it. And so we want to, you know, find a way to open up that agency. And that's where I found the Dharma practice, the sitting practice, to be helpful in informing my actions, is because I find that if I can really, really move myself into the experience of it in a deeper way, that I begin to feel a sense of agency around my response. You know, I think Viktor Frankl, who was, in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany, this famous quote, you know, there's between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our power to choose. And that's where our freedom is. And so I often think of our Dharma practice as opening up that space between stimulus and response. And as it gets wider and bigger through our practice, and we have more capacity to meet these challenges that arise in a way that is more skillful and we're not overcome by it. And so he learned this in a concentration camp. So you can imagine what it took in a situation like that to understand this creating space to respond in a skillful way. And just a story about, you know, about cancer. In fact, some years back, shortly after my husband and I got married, there was, he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. And so it was very scary, you know, of course. And you, how far had it gone? Had it spread? Unfortunately, with that type of cancer, it can't be staged, you know, how far along it is until they actually operate, until they do the surgery. And so there was a gap of time between his diagnosis and the surgery in which we didn't know how far the cancer had spread. And it was like about 2 weeks. And I realized in that experience that the level of fear that I was, the constant overwhelm of thinking, fearing, going to the worst case scenario, you know, and there was 2 weeks that my mind had to be able to do this. And I thought, I'm going to lose my mind if I spend these 2 weeks in that overwhelming kind of fear where I've been completely overcome. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And so I really relied on my practice. And so using the practice, coming back again and again to the present moment, not pushing out the stress, not saying, oh, you shouldn't be afraid, Lisa, nothing like that. But can I hold this stress in the present moment, recognizing that I don't know what his diagnosis is going to be? And so can I live here and now, not as an escape, but as a way to hold my heart and to recognize that I don't know. I just don't know. We can't know for those 2 weeks. And it's what kept me sane for those 2 weeks. I stayed sane because I did not project into all kinds of scenarios. I just stayed with my breath, my body, in the present, not denying that there was fear, but just holding that presence. And that's what got me through. That's what really kept me sane. And then thankfully, when they did the surgery, it had not spread. It was stage one. And so everything was fine. But I could have spent those 2 weeks in total, total misery if I had not been able to utilize this practice of presence in that way. So any other questions? We've got space here. If anybody has a question, we've got a little space before we close. Got a minute or two, I believe, or a few minutes. Okay, I think I see. So this is BJ, anticipatory stress with neighbors who use the USA flag, right-wing Christian views, white is better, narrowing the options of conversation and even safety. Yes, that's when we really get into that deeper stress that is really where there's real threats, you know, threats that can lead to danger possibly. And we just have to acknowledge that this stress is arising in my body, this anticipatory stress. And, you know, it's here, it's present. And first, you know, finding a way, whatever way you can, to meet that with compassion in whatever way you can. And then how do you work with that? You know, it's really challenging when we come up against those kinds of circumstances to hold our presence in our heart, knowing that there are things around us that are so difficult. And honestly, at times, what you describe, a situation like that can become overwhelming. And I do think we have to work with the process of meeting stress and compassionately meeting it, but also acknowledging when we feel really overwhelmed. And then how can we care for ourselves when we reach a point of overwhelm? What is the way of allowing the heart? What are those ways that you can find that your heart can rest for moments at a time that give you a little bit of capacity that so that you're not completely overwhelmed? And so sometimes with overwhelm, stepping away a little bit, finding those parts that the community, the practice, anything you can find that helps you to calm your mind so that then you can meet the stress again in a way that is not so overwhelming and so completely constantly distressing. So that's, and I'm sorry, I want to say, sorry that you are having to go through that. I'm sorry that this is, the kind of environment that we're living in. And of course, this isn't new, unfortunately, but I'm just sorry that's part of the environment that we have to live in. And, there's not a lot of immediate solutions, but finding those ways to support your own heart and yourself. And sometimes, again, we have to find ways to step back when we can and then come back to it if that's possible. So thank you for your question. Let's see, Dawn, can you speak about the connection impact of anticipatory stress leading to anxiety? So yes, it does. I think when anticipatory stress becomes overwhelming, like I just mentioned, it starts to, it leads to anxiety. You know, the mind pretty much, and you know, I really think we have such strong conditioned patterns around anxiety that we often don't even see it developing. It's like the mind goes there so quickly. And like you're talking about the impact and then the mind going into fear so quickly. And a lot of it is coming back to what I was speaking about with Viktor Frankl. You know, the point of, with this practice, we develop a little bit of space. So first time it happens, it may be that we are just overcome with stress and anxiety and fear. But then afterwards we say, oh, that happened. And then, so our mindfulness doesn't meet it until after the fact. But that's okay. Maybe the next time we get caught in this anxiety reaction and there's a little bit of mindfulness, but we can't stop it. But even that is being mindful and bringing our practice to what's happening. And so maybe then with patience and with continued practice, then slowly we meet it and there's a little bit of space before we go into the reaction of anxiety. And then slowly that space gets a little bit bigger. That's where we develop our agency. But it takes patience, compassion, and recognition that it's a process and that sometimes anxiety will take us over. But little by little, we open this space between stimulus and response to where we can begin to respond. And so that's the power to me of this Dharma practice. But again, we have to be kind and compassionate to ourselves when we don't respond in as skillful a way as we want. We just have to keep bringing our mindfulness to it, our patience. It's like me talking about my discomfort with public speaking. You know, I used to think, well, I should be able to bring my mindfulness to it and everything will be fine. But then I started being more patient with myself and just saying, okay, this is the way it is. Let me just be aware. This is the way it is. And slowly through that, by not having such an adversarial relationship with it, the space began to open up. And then I was able to begin to meet it in a way that was not so overwhelming, was in fact doable. And I never could have had a career in public doing Dharma teaching and talking if I had not made friends and learned to work with it. And then it started to not overcome and to become so overwhelming. You know, when I first started doing Dharma talks, I would never do more than 10 minutes. You know, it's a stretch. Now I'm up to 30 minutes. So I think that's a step up, but it took a lot. It took a lot of patience and a lot of willingness to meet it in a way that in many places it works that way. And in many areas where we just have to be patient and compassionate and keep refreshing and believing in ourselves, believing in the practice. So I think we're about out of time. I know we need to kind of close. And just as a reminder, I meant to offer a reminder about the Dana again, just to say that this session is offered entirely on a Dana basis. And that's true for Sangha Live and it's true for me. And so your generosity is what allows this to continue, and for me to continue my teachings, for Sangha Live to continue. It's your generosity. And so whatever you can give, if you can't, as we've said, you know, if you can't afford to give anything, that's perfectly okay. But if you can, look into your heart. I really like that, the heart economy. We're living, this is a whole different, I think what Martin said about, this is a heart-based economy. It's not about being forced to give a certain number, but giving from the heart, both Sangha Live and myself giving from the heart, and then giving Donna from the heart for those of you who would like to support our teaching in this way. And so there's the little button for to give and to donate. And so appreciate any offerings that you can make. And I'd like to, yeah, thank you. I was going to mention my my website, and I have a number of retreats and offerings coming up. I do teach a lot of meditation retreats, and they're all in the U.S. But so those of you in other countries, unless you're planning on coming over here, that may not be so practical. But I am going to go to Costa Rica next year. If you want to meet me, do a retreat with me in Costa Rica. But anyway, so Lisa Ernst Meditation, thank you so much for showing up. And thank you, Sangha Live, for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I hope to see you again at a future session. Thank you.